Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to One Bligh Street for today's discussion of China and Australia's relations with China. Joining me today are our East Asia Program Director, Dr. Meriden Verral, our International Security Program Director, Dr. Ewan Graham, and our Research Fellow, Peter Tsai. In recent months, the Australian debate on China has become increasingly fraught. And I think part of the reason for that is that China is such a complicated country to get your head round and such a complicated country to deal with. On the one hand, China's had magnificent successes of late, lifting about 700 million people out of poverty in the last couple of decades and really making very impressive strides along many dimensions. China has been our largest trading partner since 2007. And of course, we are host to a Chinese diaspora, roughly a million strong. But China is also a very different society from ours. It's an authoritarian state with an increasingly assertive foreign policy in the waters around its coasts. Some businesses, some community groups, some politicians are looking to shift Australia towards an even closer relationship with Beijing. Other politicians, other elements, elements in the security sector in particular, wary of Beijing's growing influence in the region, are pushing back against that development. Australian public opinion on China is mixed. We value its contribution to our prosperity, but we are wary of some of its ambitions. To give you two interesting and divergent results from this year's poll, the 2016 Lowy Institute poll, we asked Australians to identify the most important bilateral relationship to Australia. 43% chose the United States, our great treaty ally. 43% named China, a dead heat between the United States and China, which is obviously a result that would have been greeted with some happiness in Beijing. On the other hand, when we asked Australians about whether Australia should conduct freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea in response to China's activities in those waters, nearly three quarters, 74% of Australians are in favour of Australia conducting those kinds of operations, which would be highly controversial in China. So Australian public opinion is divided just as elite opinion is divided. Now, in this debate that's got increasingly fraught, there are well-established positions on China. It seems that some organisations hew to one pole or the other. The Lowy Institute is different. On China, as on every international issue, there is no orthodoxy at the Institute. We have a number of researchers who look at China from different angles and different perspectives who come to different conclusions. And we thought that having a discussion with some of those researchers may shed some light on this important bilateral relationship. As I mentioned, we have three terrific experts here. Peter is an historian by training, a journalist by background, but was also an official at Treasury, where he worked on foreign investment quite intently. Ewan is a former British official. In fact, he was the chargé d'affaires in Pyongyang, an ally of China's. But he's in particular an expert on Southeast Asia and also on maritime security, and has done a lot of work for us since he's joined the Institute on South China Sea issues. Meriden Verral has a PhD in Chinese foreign policy and lived in China working for the United Nations for 8 years. So we have three people with different backgrounds who can help us to throw some light on this. The way we're going to do today is for about 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes, I'm going to ask my colleagues some questions. And then quite early, I'm going to go to the audience and give you all an opportunity to ask some questions. So please start thinking about questions. Let me begin by asking each of my colleagues to talk for a few minutes on two questions. The first is, how would you characterise China's role in the world at the moment, China's changing role? And secondly, at a general level, how should Australia approach its relationship with China, given all the different and sometimes conflicting strands of the relationship? Peter, can I start with you?
Sure. My background is in economic analysis, so I think I would go with the economic angle. I just think the biggest change in China's role internationally for me is its economic power. I think if you look at one simple fact, back in 1978, China's share of global GDP was 1.8%. So really insignificant, 1/50 of the global economy. If you look at last year's figure, it's close to 18% of global GDP. It's gone to basically 1/5 of the global kind of a share. So it's now is the second largest economy, and every year is adding something like $600 billion. So every year is recreating one Swiss economy. So the absolute size is expanding, and also China is also world's largest trading power. And also now very soon is going to be the largest exporter of a credit as well. If you look around the region, we often talk about China as our largest trading partner. But if you look from the region, that's true pretty much for every country in the Asia-Pacific region. I mean, that's one thing we tend to forget. I mean, China's locked in a bitter dispute with Japan, but at the same time, is also Japan's largest trading partner and also largest provider for tourists to Japan as well. So even, you know, the countries hate each other in a way, but the Chinese tourists still go to Japan. So for me, that's really the foundation of China's kind of a power. So in China, there's kind of a concept called a comprehensive national power. But I think the economic is really at the very heart of it. So the rise of China is really, I think, about its the economic reinsurgence or the reemergence of China as an economic power. On the second part about Australia's relationship with China, I think in terms of economic relationship, which is, you know, in our opinion poll, we talk about China being Australia's best friend in Asia, and also the relationship is just as important as the United States. I think people are really talking about economics. But I think this is going to change, I think for a variety of reasons. The first one is that China's economy is going through change. I think we have this very heavy kind of a stage of industrialization that's already behind us. I think the China's the manufacturing's share of GDP is steadily declining, and you see the increase in service. And this means that gradually our key export to China, in terms of dollar value and in terms of importance, will gradually decline. I think tourism has already replaced the coal as the second largest export to China. What does it mean for our relationship? I think we'll get more difficult. Because if you're talking about an export of commodities, it's a very transactional relationship. You don't really have to sell the stuff very hard. So people just buy it. But now when you talk about in terms of tourism, in terms of education, it means much degree, greater degree of interaction and dealing with a lot of issues previously we don't have to think about. And also as China becomes the world's largest exporter of credit. And this will be a very testing for Australia in terms of how to deal with foreign investment coming into Australia. I think previously, I mean, the economic relationship is kind of easy to manage. But I think going forward, even this element of relationship will become more difficult. How do you deal with large influx of tourists? How do you deal with the students and associated problem? How do you deal with the Chinese investment into Australia, especially into infrastructures and et cetera? I think even this element is going to be more challenging down the track.
All right, we'll come back to foreign investment. Ewan, those two questions. Where would you locate China at the moment in the world, and how should Australia react to China?
Well, it's a reflection of China's influence on global debates that most of the questions I get asked in some form relate to China. That tells its own story. And 5 years ago, it wouldn't have been as intense as it is now. As a reflection of that very sharp curve, I think the issue that China confronts itself is that it's grown so fast that I'm not sure that China knows exactly where its end goal is. Clearly, there is a desire to have a more prominent role on the stage and an assertion of its interests, including its sovereignty claims up front, much more central in terms of China's willingness to put those at every seat at the table that it has, right up to the UN. But certainly where we feel it the most, and I'd identify 2009-2010 as a sort of threshold, a much stronger assertiveness on sovereignty claims in particular. And we've seen that identified with the personality of Xi Jinping in particular. Where should Australia broach China in its relationship? I mean, Peter said that he sees things primarily through an economic lens. I suppose I see things primarily through a security lens, but I think the key point is that we can't really afford to silo these two debates. That's what's changed for me in the last few months, is that the importance of, on the one hand, recognizing the economic opportunity, but also the strategic risk aspects, and that these two things, these two debates, have not really had to confront each other in Australia because the business community has not, by and large, had to deal with political questions, and the security questions have been more or less at a kind of an elite and closed governmental level. That's no longer the case, and I think we've seen these several developments, the South China Sea being one, the Ausgrid decision, the vote, by the influence peddling questions around Senator Dastyari, all came together very quickly, and I think exposed the limits of the ability of those two parts of the debate to actually share a common vocabulary. I think if there is a common vocabulary, it would be around the management of risk, and that's why I hesitate to present China in terms of threat. But certainly, as we've seen the South China Sea just in the last week bubbling up again as a domestic issue between the opposition and the coalition, Australia now, it's no longer an abstract concern. China is felt increasingly as an issue that Australia has to confront directly, but also as a major question within the alliance with the United States.
Great. We'll return to the South China Sea. Meriden.
I think China's rise is often characterised in words like being a nervous superpower, that it's being more assertive, it's being more aggressive, and we use these sort of shorthand terms. But I think there's these sorts of expressions are behaviours. These are symptomatic of something that's much deeper and requires a more in-depth understanding. And as many of you may already know, I'm looking at things through a political anthropology kind of lens, so we've all got our different perspectives. And I particularly concentrate on this idea of China having particular worldviews that inform the way it behaves and inform what it's doing on the international stage. And I think we need to understand these worldviews to understand characterising China's role in the world. So in summary, the worldviews that I put forward are the idea that China thinks that it has suffered a century of humiliation, a victimisation narrative. Secondly, that history is destiny. That is to say that it is used to be a regional power and a very important force, and that will come around again. Thirdly, that the region is a family hierarchy with China as the kind of central figure. And fourthly, that cultural characteristics are unchanging, that there are certain attributes that Chinese culture has, and there are certain attributes that Western Americans, Australians have, and these are fixed. Now, I just want to say that all of these are changeable, they're politically constructed, they're not necessarily immutable in any way. If you take those as your basis for understanding China, or if you take some kind of understanding from a Chinese perspective of understanding China, then China's changing role in the world is actually unsurprising. It's something that has been building up for decades. When the patriotic education campaign started after Tiananmen in 1989, this whole idea of China as a victim, as having been humiliated by others and wanting to come back from that, that's been going for a long time, for decades. So this is now the time in which they have the abilities and the space to pursue those goals that have been the core of their identity for decades. So China's role in the world is not just assertive. It's not just a nervous superpower. These are too simple. It's something that's much deeper than that, and it's something that's a much longer-term core goal. So then how should Australia approach its relationship with China? I completely agree with you in that we can't silo different perspectives. We can't say this is economics and this is political. This is security. And in fact, I think that those two silos are insufficient in themselves, even if they are having a common vocabulary. That's not enough. Coming again from a political anthropology point of view, I think that they're insufficient for understanding what's happening. And we need to approach our relationship with China in a much more nuanced and complex way than whether or not it's just a risk, whether or not there's opportunities for economic growth. We have to look at that in a much more comprehensive and holistic way. And that takes a lot of careful, deliberate reflection on our part.
Right. Thank you very much. Let me dive into some of the questions that people alluded to and some other questions I have. Peter, foreign investment is obviously, is the area where these two debates that Ewan and Meriden spoke of come together. And we've had a number of decisions recently that have angered certainly some in the Australian business community. So how well is the Australian government striking the balance at the moment between being open to the kind of investment that Scott Morrison stood on this stage 2 weeks ago and said we're open to it, at the same time protecting areas, whether it be national security or other areas of striking national interests such that that might rise to the level of disallowing certain investment? How's the government doing at the moment, do you think?
I think when it comes to foreign investment, it's actually a very political process. I mean, we have to remember it's actually not the Foreign Investment Review Board that makes a decision. It's the Treasurer, and he's the elected of politicians. He has to respond to public concerns. And what we have seen so far from our opinion polls consistently, there's a strong popular backlash against foreign investment. It's actually nothing new. In the 1960s, it was against American and British. And in the 1980s with the Japanese and the 70s, I think this is a kind of a continuation of a long tradition, so to speak. So for the politicians who are making decisions, they have to take this into consideration on the loosely defined national interest, which no one knows whatever that is. And just particular, it's actually someone explained to me, an expert, it goes into the state of mind of the Treasurer at a particular time. That's why no one's ever able to challenge the particular decision, because you can't approve or disprove what Treasurer, thinks at a time. So it's actually a very difficult process. In terms of clarity, I think it's, for the international investor, I think it's quite important. We can actually set out some ground rules. For example, if we're not happy or particularly concerned about the state ownership of a certain asset, so let's introduce some cap, be 25% or 30% or whatever the number people feel is comfortable. So let out in the front so people have a quite good idea about what is allowed and what is not allowed. So I think people, if there's one thing I think the business people hate more then really tighter regulations, I think, is uncertainty. So let's get that one done. I think another important debate I find is really interesting, the whole foreign investment debate is a focus around the foreign investment. This is a pre-screening stage. I think people, a very little time we spend talking about Australia's overall the regulatory environment. Don't we have any belief in our system where we have ACCC, ASIC, and ATO? I can tell you, ATO is a far more powerful, angry beast for foreign investors than the FIRB. FIRB does not have a lot of enforcement mechanism or even experience. But when you talk about ATO, when Australian Taxation Office takes interest in what you do here, that's when you have to be really scared. And also ACCC, these are much more angry, powerful, and resourced regulators. I think when we talk about a foreign investment, we have to talk about a strengthening overall the regulatory environment. And in this regard, I think we can actually play a very positive role. If we take in the Chinese foreign investor, let's say in Australia, because in China, the corporate governance standard, etc., are quite weak. Once they come to Australia, they have to be socialized into a much better standard of behavior. I think that's where Australian regulatory environment can actually play a very good role and a positive role to bring them up to the standard we are expected. For example, you probably remember the story about a Hang Lung executive that took advantage of insider information. They got jailed and imprisoned. I think that's really good because it shows that if you're here, you can't do that kind of stupid things. And when you do breach Australian rules, and you'll be punished. I think this actually encourages much better standard of behaviors down the track. I think the more we do that, socialize into a better behavior, is actually positive for Australia and also positive for the Chinese investors. One example is MNG. If you see that company, how that is being run, by an Australian CEO with an Australian management team is actually giving China's investor a very good return. They're actually learning from that experience, having professionals to run the joint, so to speak. I think there's actually one area where we can play a better role, but I find it's disappointing we have not been talking about that.
Meriden, foreign investment was one of the issues that caught the public's eye in the last month or two, but the other was the question of the Chinese government using the large number of Chinese Australians as tools of influence. And I think what was lost a little bit in some of the reporting is just how diverse the Chinese Australian community is in Australia. Can you remind us a little bit about that diversity?
Yeah, sure. It's an interesting question because, as you say, there's a lot more to the Chinese diaspora than just one monolithic group. And one thing that I think is really important is to remember that something that I referred to before was this patriotic education campaign that started in the 1990s in China after Tiananmen. And to just remember that the Chinese people around the mid-20s to mid-30s have been deeply, deeply steeped in an incredible campaign of ideological education. And so we might assume that the Chinese younger people, younger generation, are perhaps they've had access to information that their older counterparts mightn't have had. They've perhaps travelled overseas, they've perhaps studied overseas, perhaps they've got a different perspective on international issues. But they're in fact probably more likely than their older counterparts, their older demographic, to be deeply, deeply patriotic and deeply, deeply committed to the idea of the Chinese national identity, to those worldviews that I mentioned before. This patriotic education campaign was nationwide, a huge mass ideological campaign, and it infiltrated to all the schools, everything. All the textbooks were rewritten. So we mustn't just assume that all Chinese people are equally likely to be tools of influence. And we must also perhaps challenge our assumption that younger people are going to be more likely to be more internationally minded than their older counterparts.
Because with some of the previous generations, you've got people of Chinese ethnicity who've moved here from Southeast Asian countries or right. families indeed who've been here for a century.
Yep.
But there is there something different about the newer generation of immigrants? What you're saying is they're more likely to be more patriotic, more likely to have more of an attachment to the PRC, is that right?
Yes, that's basically it. I remember during the Olympic Torch rally, when Australia was holding the Olympics, and the Olympic Torch came through Canberra, and you may remember there was a lot of Chinese students who were there for various reasons, mostly there to support China. And it was fascinating to look at the demographics of those groups of people. They were young people, and having conversations with them about why they felt that way, why they felt so absolutely wedded to their views. It was very emotional. It wasn't necessarily a rational argument that they could sort of step through in point, counterpoint. It was just a deeply held, visceral sense of loyalty. And I think that may be something to keep in mind when you're thinking about this question.
Mm-hmm. Ewan, let me ask you the last question for this part of the event, and then I'm going to offer the opportunity to the audience to ask some questions. You mentioned in your opening remarks, Ewan, that the South China Sea, even in the past week, has been become a domestic issue in Australia, and you wrote a very interesting article on The Interpreter this morning on just that particular incident where the shadow defence minister made some remarks about how the Australian government would authorise freedom of navigation operations and so on, and was then criticised by former Prime Minister Keating and by the government and so on. So it is becoming an issue, and it's becoming an issue that is creating sometimes unlikely coalitions, and sometimes the alliances are not a little bit unexpected. Can you, for those of us who are not experts, the issue of freedom of navigation operations can be quite a complicated one. So can you just tell us, I mentioned in my opening that nearly three quarters of Australians favour us conducting our own phone-ops in the South China Sea. Can you tell us what is Australia's declared position on the South China Sea, and what are we doing about it? What sort of operations are we running, and what sort of operations are we not running at the moment?
Sure, I'll try and simplify it as far as possible, because if anything ever deserved the devil is in the detail label, it's A, the South China Sea disputes, and B, the technical definition of freedom of navigation and overflight. And I think that's part of the problem, is that the micro-focus has been down at that level, and regardless of the poll result that we saw, I think it's an honest reflection that most members of the public probably won't understand exactly what that means. There isn't a sort of hard and fast government policy. It has to be inferred. And I think my reading of it is that there is an awkwardness in the government's position. On the one hand, that there's been very fulsome declaratory support for the principle of freedom of navigation and overflight, in support of international law and peaceful resolution of disputes. These are statements that you see repeated throughout, both in public utterances from ministers and, in fact, in the defence white paper that was released earlier this year. On the other hand, the principle is there, but the practice is where the question mark is, that Australia, and it appears now on the basis of what Julie Bishop was quoted as saying last week, that it is a case that Australia has not been within 12 nautical miles of any of the features that are occupied by China in the South China Sea. And that puts the government in a slightly awkward spot for obvious reasons, because ultimately the question about where do you put your principles into practice has to be asked. And I think that's what the opposition has understood, that there's some political play at that. But I wouldn't belittle it all as just domestic politics either. I think it does serve a broader educating function, and also a necessary debate that has to be had here. And this is not a bad time to have it, because I think we're in a kind of period now where we've got an outgoing US administration. We've got a lot of uncertainty about whether Philippines itself is going to go in its direction. It brought the case that has received so much attention. And I think now we may have a lead up of several weeks to the election, and then knowing where the US will be in future. And I think articulating our own, where our national interests lie, where we're prepared to actually put words into action or not, and more importantly, I think to do it as a broader based, if it has an operational aspect, I think maybe the window for a solo Australian freedom of navigation operation is closing, and that to have the effect, the desired effect on as demonstrating to China that there is a kind of path of resistance, and I choose my word carefully, but I think that is important, that it's done so on a multinational level. I didn't quite answer your question. I think if I could sort of summarise where I think the government is at, the government says that the principle of freedom of navigation and overflight is something that that Australia supports. However, the Australian Navy and Air Force, while they operate regularly in the South China Sea, have not specifically performed a freedom of navigation of operation. Mm.
And just for clarity, when you say the window of opportunity for Australia to conduct a solo FONOP is closing, and it may be that if we were to do this, we'd have to consider a multinational one. What are the other nations, what are the other navies that you're considering we may want to operate with?
Well, the obvious shortlist is US allies, but I don't think that's sufficient, for the obvious reason that it looks to Chinese eyes, and this is where Meriden's point absolutely comes in. You have to be able to look at it through Chinese eyes, that it then begins to look like a confected assembly of allies who've received a late night telephone call from the US president or someone senior. I think it has to have Southeast Asian representation. I think that's essential. And that, I think, would give it a lot more credibility. And I think it's also important that it doesn't just look as a as a short list of European or treaty allies of the United States, but there are broader principles at stake. This formulation of rules-based, I think, is a useful one. The liberal part, maybe not so much, because I think that's where we're less likely to get buy-in across the region. But the buy-in to rules-based is something that I think does cut across different political systems, and that countries in Southeast Asia, and I pick out Singapore just because I spend a lot of time thinking about the Australia-Singapore relationship, there's a country that has an independently defined national interest in freedom of navigation, which is more acute than the case for Australia. Obviously, managing the China relationship puts Singapore in potential awkwardness there. But my overriding point is that I think we do have to accept a higher level of risk now, and within bounds, to be able to push back and make that point to China, which I don't think is China doing China a disservice. For the original point I started out from, that I'm not sure China knows exactly what it wants.
Very good. Who else would like to join me in asking some questions of these Lowy Institute experts?
Alex Carradus, interested member of the public. I'm concerned about the soft power that China is pursuing in Australia, aka Sam Dastyari.
So what's the question?
I'm just concerned of it. Concerned of Dulles Hill.
Okay. All right, so I guess the question is, for whomever would like to have a go at it, what do we think about, I mean, just to explore some of those issues, there's been reporting from Chris Uhlman at the ABC of millions of dollars of funding from entities that have various links, of various tightness to the Chinese state into Australian political parties. There's been a lot of discussion of what impact that has on Australian policy. While my colleagues are thinking, I mean, I would say that one interesting effect of the Dastyari affair has probably been to limit the influence or the effectiveness of those donations, and has probably been to freeze a policy in its current form in a way. I mean, I think politicians now will be very reluctant, I think, to get outside their lane on any of these questions for the next few months, because they don't want to look like they have been influenced in any way by donations. So, I mean, that has both positive and negative elements. It probably means there's a bit less room for creativity and an interesting discussion on it. Probably people are going to be very careful to stick to their talking points, the approved talking points. Who would like to come to this question of, I guess, Chinese political influence in Australia? Ewan?
Maybe I can start and put it in a global context. It's not just Australia and China that face this in isolation. There's a much broader crisis in Western politics, and part of that is around the susceptibility of elections and politicians on an individual or party basis to foreign influence. And we've seen that in particular with the questions around the association between Russia and the Donald Trump Trump campaign in the United States, but in Europe too, even in countries that have law that actually forbids foreign donations. There are, of course, ways around that, ways of putting in money indirectly. But I think the question that very usefully flushed out in Australia was that weakness, particularly the absence of legislation around foreign donations to political parties, and that may be one policy consequence that is positively going forward from this. The way I'd answer your question about concern, I think there is a need for people to be more alert that as China becomes more assertive and focused on its sovereignty interests, that there's an expectation around so-called countries in its periphery, and Australia, I think, is included within that broader Chinese view of the region and the world, need to take China's interests into account, to be supportive and, as far as possible, uncritical of China's foreign policy positions. And that, of course, raises all sorts of questions for Australian sovereignty that needs, I think, now to be much more directly in people's minds and the minds of politicians. And I think that's that, to me, certainly is going to be a continuing question going forward. It's where I think Hugh White is probably half right in that there is a China choice, but the choice is increasingly being exerted on behalf of Beijing, that believes that countries need to choose China and using the economic implied leverage, although I think there are all sorts of questions about that, of being the number one trading partner and increasingly a source of investment.
Would you guys like to add, Peter?
Just add some of the smaller points. I think the first thing is some of the biggest donors are actually Australian citizens. So even if we change the foreign donation law, it probably would not stop some of the biggest donors because they are citizens. So there's kind of whole different issues. And the second set of issues is when you lump all this together, some of them actually I look at it. One of the guy I actually interviewed in the past, he used to be a Liberal candidate for the city, for a city in Brisbane. He's like a Taiwanese. So I don't even know why he's lumped together. And I think other things, I mean, I'm not so sure whether all the donations are going to try to influence South China. Say, if you see a lot of property developers there, they probably try to influence state members of parliaments. And so I think we have to kind of understand, kind of a breakdown for these donations. And also, sometimes how much influence do they really have? Because one of the donors donated, I think, $500,000 to Western Australian branch of the Liberal Party. It clearly has no influence over Judy Bishop's foreign policy. So I think we have to be aware of this type of influence buying activities, but sometimes I'm just wondering how much effect does it really have? So that's kind of just some of my observation.
You can't always draw a clear line between the two, but I would say that MPs of both political parties have said to me privately that they feel under some constraints about talking about China, that they feel that there is enough money sloshing around that it's a factor in what they say about Australia's relations with China. It's influencing their thinking. So I think your points are well taken. You can't lump, it doesn't make sense to lump it all together, and people donate to political parties for lots of different reasons. But there, nevertheless, something is happening, I think, that's interesting. Yes, sir.
John Allen, I've got a number of relationships. I'd like to talk about the South China Sea and the fact that Australia should be a little bit more nuanced in its response. The comment that we should look at these things sometimes through Chinese eyes, I think, is relevant. My understanding of China foreign policy is that it's a two-level policy, one for its neighbours, whether it's Kazakhstan, India, Thailand, Burma, North Korea, and a second one for the broader world position, in which I think Australia is in the second. Now, China, as you said, is the largest trading country, and desperately needs to have freedom of trade for its own purposes. So I think what you're seeing in the South China Sea is the last part of their border which needs to be protected, therefore they are, I think, distinguishing between security of their border and the need for global trade and economic well-being.
John, can I bring you to your question?
I was going to ask for a comment.
Okay. I'm not going to take it as a comment. I'm going to take it as a question. So John is asking about the Chinese perspective here. I mean, is it fair to say that in some way the South China Sea is a Chinese border? Or should we be thinking about it in different ways?
A great deal of the angst and concern has been about the fact that border or boundary, maybe more correct, has been extremely ambiguous, that we don't know exactly what China's position is, especially on the so-called 10-dash line in the South China Sea. I add there is a 10th one off Taiwan as well. And you hear different things depending on what part of the Chinese system you engage with. And I think as long as that ambiguity holds about where the border lies, it's perfectly understandable that countries in Southeast Asia are going to feel extremely nervous about what China's intentions are, even though they may be, as you're implying, I think, defensively conceived. I don't mean to paint China entirely in terms of the aggressor in the South China Sea. I think all rising powers, particularly those that are not particularly well served by geography, and the so-called first island chain doesn't help China as a maritime power trying to get access to the open Pacific. But nonetheless, I think we're now so far down the track in terms of China's willingness to exert high pressure tactics, and frankly, to bully smaller countries, including friends like Singapore that have in the past really attempted to be as accommodating of China as a rising power, and actually almost to represent that position on a global stage, that I think the facts on the ground are now that Southeast Asia, where 10 years ago there was almost uniform goodwill towards China, now there is a very deep ambivalence and certainly real concern about where that will end. And I think the core question is not to focus so much on the boundary, but what does the South China Sea really mean? I think it's the concern behind it is where will it end? If China doesn't know exactly how far it wants to go as a rising power, then I think trying to accommodate that and preemptively concede to China what people impose as an external construct of what is fair and proper may actually lead to longer term and harder issues down the track. That's why I think reacting now within the bounds of acceptable risk is actually it's prudent, because the costs 5-10 years down the track will be higher, I fear.
Just to follow up on that, Ewan, and then Meredith, I'll come to you. I mean, some people are now starting to say, well, look, China's won the argument in the South China Sea because they have been much more aggressive in building up these various water features, and there are limits to how people will oppose them. We had this very clear statement of the international legal position from the Permanent Court of Arbitration. However, just at that moment, the Filipinos in their wisdom elected Mr. Duterte, who is not interested, it appears, in putting up a robust case towards China. Is that true? Has China won the argument, or is it still important that other countries continue to contest those claims?
I think it is important, and I think this is, as I wrote in the piece in The Interpreter this morning, this is a troubling period for the reasons that you've identified, added to which, of course, is the distraction of the United States, unable really to focus and provide that leadership at the moment. So I think there is a sense of drift, an awkwardness about how far people should expend political capital with their relationship with China, when the Philippines itself is now going the opposite direction and leaning in very heavily towards China. But I think there is still a lot to play for in the South China Sea. I think international law works in a sort of rather mercurial but long-term way, and expecting a short-term gain out of that judgment was never really realistic in my eyes. And I don't think China can afford to ignore it either. More importantly, when you speak to people who know China better than we do in Australia on the whole, Vietnamese, for example, they also make a similar judgment that there is an inevitability that China will react badly and negatively, and that we're feeling some of that at the moment. But the trick is always to be able to do it in a way that doesn't give China the excuse to militarize those features further or to push it into a corner, but at the same time provides enough resistance so that there are we're aiding people within the Chinese system who actually understand that their claims now have been significantly struck down in an international legal ruling that will never go away, that is final and non-appealable.
Meredith.
I'd like to go back to John's original question, as translated by you, which was, does China see this as a border or in different ways? And I think, and you mentioned, John, to see this through a Chinese lens, and I think this is an absolutely critical spot where we could try applying a Chinese lens and see what we can get out of it. And this question of, does China see it as a border? It's ambiguous. We don't know where the lines are. Isn't that disturbing? Chinese Chinese see things in relationally in concentric circles, and they see the region as a family unit with themselves in the middle. And in fact, a Chinese general just said at the Shengshan Forum in the last couple of days, you know, the region is a family. Let's keep the family spirit alive. So they're seeing the Asian region as this concentric circle relationship, and you know, Australia's a fair bit out of that, China's in the middle, and these other Southeast Asian countries are kind of, they're important, but they're less important than China. And these borders, these are not fixed borders. These are not sort of ideas of like a fixed nation state delineation. These are very tenuous notions of ownership and who's inside and outside. So for us to say, you know, there's a fixed line, what does it mean, China? It's the wrong question in a way, because it's, you're not necessarily going to get an answer because it's not how it's conceptualized on the other side. So whether or not China sees it as a border, the answer's kind of no, and it's then the beginning of a bigger question that is much more important, I think.
Did you have a two-finger, Ewan?
Yes, just briefly to add to that, I think where Australia also features in Chinese thinking, which we haven't referred to so far, but its importance as an ally of the United States and how China reacts to Australia also needs to be understood in that light. And it's no coincidence, I think, that China has put particular pressure on not just on Australia, but the other partners in the region, Philippines and also Singapore. Though it's not a treaty ally, it's a very close security relationship. And I think we do see a pattern in that China is attempting where it can to drive a wedge within the alliance, by exposing the sensitivity around questions such as, will Australia show support for the United States operationally? So I think I take Merida's point, and I'm not contradicting that, but I think as well as the concentric geographically familial relations, there's also a very tactical point about splintering alliances.
Aaron, I saw Aaron and then the gentleman at the back.
Thanks, Michael. Aaron Conley from the Institute. I'm curious, there's an old debate about diplomacy with China and, in fact, with several other Asian countries as well, as to whether it's better to state your position straightforwardly or whether that can sometimes cause a loss of face that can be counterproductive. And specifically on this South China Sea issue, there was a concerted campaign by China to drum up support for its position around the world, and they really fell short in that. And that must have been tremendously embarrassing to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I'm just wondering, Ewan and Meriden, if you have views as to whether or not the statements that in support of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, in support of the rules-based order, do you think that those were counterproductive in that they caused a loss of face that caused China to sort of lash out? Or do you think they were productive in demonstrating to China where global opinion was?
I mean, it was a sort of... And we've heard about the coalition of the willing. I don't know what the correct way to describe the coalition that China had thought it had assembled, but I sort of facetiously called it the coaling of the unaware. Many of those countries actually didn't put out the positions that China claimed that they did. And I think that obviously was embarrassing once it became clear that the rebuttal from those states came back. Even Cambodia, who we think of as being, in China's pocket, equivocated on its level of support for for China's position. China's had one major gain since, which is Russia. Russia had taken a very neutral, middle-of-the-road position on the South China Sea for the very pragmatic reason, among others, that it has a close relationship with Vietnam. And we saw at the G20 summit on the margins, President Putin's statement and the military exercise that followed appeared to take Russia into a much more partial position. So that might be quite a strong grain of comfort, I think, for China since. As far as the other collection of states, you know, the Gambia and Vanuatu, we haven't heard much reference to that since. And I think it does become obvious that against the ledger of countries that have given support for the PCA ruling, China is, I think, in that it exposes the contradiction more writ large in China's rise, is that the more powerful it becomes, in some senses, it exposes how few allies it has. And that, I think, is it reinforces the difficulty of that position for Beijing.
I think that's an interesting point about how it exposes that it doesn't have terribly many allies. And the question is, to what extent does that matter, and why would that matter? So talking about losing face, we've got an international arena and you've got your domestic political arena. You've lost face in the international arena, certainly, because you were hoping that this was going to justify your position. But what does that matter, really, to the leadership? If the domestic political scenario can be shaped in order for that loss of face to fit into one of those existing narratives in which you're being victimized by the rest of the world again, domestically you're fine, and that's what matters more. So, yes, it's a loss of face, but to what extent that absolutely matters is a different question.
Good afternoon. My name's Sean Gillespie. Just got a question around cybercrime. Around the world, China's accused of significant cybersecurity breaches. If found to be true, how do governments deal with that? How do they deal with that, and what advice would you give in terms of government to deal with that, especially in the contradiction of you've got a significant trading partner and on the one hand, compared to you've got a significant loss of trust on the other side?
It's complicated, isn't it? Who would like to have a go at cyber?
I can start.
Yep.
Here I think the United States is ahead of the curve because it's been on the receiving end, and there was a clear effort to broker some sort of bilateral deal that the United States has claimed has actually brought down very significantly the incidence of cybercrime. So that may be a evidence for the benefit of the direct approach. The other point I would make in answer to your question is that I think cybercrime does alert businesses to the downside risk of dealing with China. And in that sense, it's not unhelpful, although we tend to view it very much through a kind of threat and challenge lens. But it gets back to this dissonance between the economic business-driven debate, which largely sees China as an unalloyed opportunity, whereas the government position is much more focused on risk. And it helps persuade businesses of the case for their own commercial operations being at stake on issues of politics, of issues of sovereignty and international relations. So in that sense, it can help internally to develop a coherent strategy. But I think we're still at the baby steps stage here in Australia. And we've had recently evidence coming out that the Bureau of Meteorology was subjected to a foreign government attack, and clearly, although there's been no definitive word on where that came from, the strong suspicion is that sources within China were responsible.
We've got time. Yes, Peter, go on.
Just probably add one point. You have already seen BHP move its kind of IT and office out of China to Singapore due to IT concern. But I think the bigger trend with this cyber crime and espionage is you're going to say, I mean, for me, I used to cover a bit of a technology. I think the bigger worry for me is you're going to see a tribalization of a technology. I think, Huawei is being blocked here in Australia and also United States. What are you going to say in the future in China? Is going to Cisco's and et cetera will be blocked in the Chinese market? Actually, in fact, their gears have been stripped out of a Chinese backbone service. So for long times, we benefited from the diffusion and the globalization of the technology. I think down the track, what are going to say that the Chinese company going to increasingly rely on Chinese technology servers and the telecommunication equipment makers, and Americans and other Western countries are going to increasingly rely on more Western gears. I think that's kind of a sad byproduct of the cybercrime and espionage is we're going to see a lesser diffusion of a technology, which I think is a really sad trend.
Yeah. Got time for one more quick question from this gentleman.
Don Beresford. Completely different. It's about the clash of cultures between Australia and China. Bearing in mind that tourism is growing at an enormous rate, 1.4 million per annum, What could Australia do better in terms of catering for Chinese tourists, bearing in mind the difference between the cultures?
What can Australia do
to... koalas? I think we could get more koalas. That would probably...
I think on the tourism, maybe, I think part of tourism is actually related to the large body of Chinese students in Australia. I think there's like, 200,000 or 180,000 Chinese students who are studying in Australia. I think we can do a lot better in terms of looking after their interests and needs. I think a lot of them come here to study accounting, IT or engineering. They actually have very little exposure, let's say, to Australian histories and the politics and etc. So you actually have a really sad situation, and after spending 3 or 4 years studying Australia, having spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're having a very sketchy understanding of Australian history, politics, traditions, and etc. So I think it's really sad because they don't have a full experience of Australia. And I think, in a way, we have unconsciously lost a lot of really good ambassadors for Australia in the future. I think we milked the whole thing as an education export industry. But in terms of a return, we haven't returned that much for the long-term benefit. I think if we can, give some of the money back in terms of a better education experience, I think that will also help our tourism industry as well. Because the more that they like Australia, the better experience they are, the most likely they're going to tell their relatives, their parents, their friends to come to visit Australia. I think that's something we can do.
You want to add anything?
Yeah, sure, just quickly. There's been some interesting research about Chinese tourists overseas and travellers overseas and what they're looking for when they travel. And it's, generally speaking, a very different kind of experience than say, Australians look for when they're travelling in all the diversity. It's, Chinese tourists tend to travel in groups. They're not necessarily individuals who are going backpacking or, of course there's exceptions, or going on woofing adventures in organic farms. So we have to also think about what it is that we want to provide without changing too much. And I do remember a classic remark when I was in Venice, overhearing some Chinese tourists in Venice saying, "It's a bit old." So we have to think about what it is that we can offer.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a very interesting conversation. We've gone from the downsides of the relationship to the upsides. We've been from cybercrime to koalas. There's a lot we didn't get into. We didn't have a chance to talk about Xi Jinping and about his impact on the relationship, or about One Belt, One Road, which is the topic of a paper that Peter is finalising for us. There are going to be many other opportunities to discuss these issues at the Institute. There's no bigger question for Australia's foreign relations and our relationship with China, and it's an issue that we will continue to try to throw a light onto from many different angles, as I've said and as we've demonstrated today. One thing to keep an eye out for is that we've had nearly 10 years of debate on this topic on The Interpreter, on Australia's digital magazine, and we've recently created a feature where you can look at The Interpreter and you can access 10 years of debate on this topic that the rest of Australia has woken up to in the last 6 months or so. So keep coming back to the Institute. We're going to keep addressing these topics. We didn't discuss the United States much today, but the good news is that the day after the election, the presidential election, on I think it's either the 9th or the 10th of November, we're going to do a panel debate here on what the US election result means for us and what President Clinton will mean for the relationship with Australia. But we'll also, in that discussion, we'll also look at what the election means for the US relationship with China. So please come and join us on that occasion. Thank you very much. And thank you to my colleagues.